In this episode, we speak with the founder and CEO of Masterworks, Scott Lin. Specializing in the art investment market, Masterworks securitizes blue chip artworks between $1 to $20 million per painting and sells shares to over 200,000 investors via their site. Blue chip art has historically retained its value and appreciated in times of high inflation. Masterworks was founded in 2017 by Scott to make the art market more accessible to investors. Scott is an early internet entrepreneur with a focus on online advertising, MarTech, and FinTech. Over the past 15 plus years, he's founded, acquired, sold, or remained a controlling shareholder in over a dozen tech companies. Prior to Masterworks, Scott founded Payability, V2 Ventures, and Virtu Mundo. I'm your host, RJ Lumba. We hope you enjoy the show. If you like the episode, click to follow.
RJ Lumba is the executive chairman of Market Insight Media and the managing partner of Growth Cap. He is the host of Great Entrepreneurs, a podcast for driven entrepreneurs and business owners. Our podcast covers all topics related to the entrepreneurial journey, from ideation to execution to optimization and to reaping the rewards of a well-run business. In the minutes ahead, we'll share with you unique insights and tactics from some of today's most accomplished and inspiring entrepreneurs.
Scott, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. It's a delight to be with you.
Thanks for having me.
So as I was reviewing your background, I noticed you've done quite a bit in the field of starting businesses, starting running, exiting businesses. Do you just have this natural inclination to start things? And does that continue even though you've already started so many other businesses?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I always tell people, I describe it more as, I think starting businesses is a skill set. And I started my first company in high school, and I've started many since. And you kind of just develop this framework around how to build a business, right? Like, how do you think about strategy? How do you hire people? How do you start scaling? And I think once you understand that formula, you just sort of repeat it. I mean, I would say that like starting businesses is hard, right? It's not fun. If I had kids, I'm not sure if I would encourage them to do it. But I think once that becomes what you know, you just keep repeating it.
And how do you decide which businesses to go in? Do you say like, oh man, that would be so cool if we did this, or I think this would make a ton of money, so we're going to head in that direction? Like, what is the lever or the idea that makes you want to do the business?
I think that's a really important question. And I think when I think about my career and how it's evolved, I think that is one thing that I think about very differently today than I did when I was, you know, starting my very first company over 20 years ago. And I tend to think about that question today more in terms of a fundamental strategy question. So if I'm starting a new business, what is the total available market size? Is there competition? Can I differentiate? How sustainable do I think the strategy is? You know, what does the revenue model look like? What is the gross margin profile? So you start to become more sophisticated about that analysis over time. I mean, when I go back to my first handful of companies, I would say, I didn't think about that at all, right? I really thought about how can I make money? You know, how can we execute as fast as possible? And I think the thing that you learn over time is, even if you're working 12 hours a day and you have an amazing team of 100 people working for you, if you're executing on the wrong problem, you're still not really going anywhere. Mm-hmm. So I think today at whatever, 44 years old now, I'm more thoughtful about that.
What I'm hearing is that it's primarily about scope and scale. Like, is this a big enough idea or problem to solve?
I think that's part of it. I think the other question is often competition. How sustainable is that moat? You know, what does the business look like in 10 years? I think some of the biggest businesses in the world today, they've been really good at strategy, and I think they've frankly been somewhat poor at execution, but they're still really large companies. So I think managers, particularly new managers, put too much of a focus on execution, working long, working hard. And it's not that that's not important, it is, but again, you've got to have the right strategy to begin with.
And then currently, your productive hours during the day, are they all focused on Masterworks, or are you working on a portfolio of businesses and projects?
In my world today, I'm 90% focused on Masterworks. I mean, I still have other companies that I own or that I've started, but they're run by other CEOs. So more of a passive investor, more or less. Yeah.
So Masterworks stands out because it's actually one of the kind of coolest companies and startups out there. Not many people are playing in this space, or maybe not many people are known to be playing in this space in the way you are. So tell us about how you came up with the idea, and then we'll go a little bit further into the business.
Yeah, so I had the idea of Masterworks because I've been collecting art for 20 years, right? So just as long as I've been starting companies, I've been collecting art, and I've seen the value of my own art collection grow. Now, the thing that's really interesting about the art market is that, and a lot of people don't appreciate this, there's a very long track record of data that helps you understand how art has been appreciating because art sells at public auction. So the two largest auction houses, Christie's and Sotheby's, have both been around more than 200 years. So you have this asset class where you have a 200-year track record on what things have been sold for at public auction, and you can analyze that to understand how is it appreciating. So I started doing that work over a decade ago just out of curiosity, because I was curious to understand how does the appreciation of art compare to things like public equities. And what you learn is that art in general outperforms most other asset classes, but the segment of the art market that outperforms are generally very expensive paintings. They're paintings that we say in today's world are more than $500,000 in value. Like, that segment of the market has the most interesting risk-adjusted returns. So the problem with that, the inherent issue with that, is that you have to have $1 million to buy a painting, tens of millions of dollars to build a portfolio. So therefore, this asset class has really been restricted to the ultra wealthy. So to me, that was a natural problem to solve, right? Like, that was a way to take a painting, break it up into shares, and then let anyone invest in it so anyone can have exposure to these objects that otherwise are outperforming other asset classes. So that was the origin of the idea. And then, you know, I went through a process similar to what I just talked through, where I started thinking about, you know, how does this idea evolve? Can it be differentiated? What will competition look like? In our world, what is the regulatory framework? What are all the components of the business that we need to put together to make this work? But yeah, I mean, 5 years later, I'm still really just focused on Masterworks.
And it seems like you've brought a lot of people to the platform. You attracted a lot of people to Masterworks. Was the adoption kind of on pace with what you expected? Was it more? Was it less?
I don't think anything in startup world is ever what you expected. You know, I think one of the hard things about running a startup is just everything you expect and every assumption you make is always wrong. It's more a lifestyle of just learning to consistently pivot and iterate based on those learnings. But our business has changed a lot since the beginning. I mean, I think the high level idea, the high level concept behind Masterworks is the same, but we've definitely went through many different types of evolutions. Like, for example, when we first launched the platform, you can invest in paintings with just $20. $20 was literally our minimum. Now we have phone calls with financial advisors where we take the onboarding process very seriously. We talk about what you're investing in today, you know, what sort of allocation art makes sense for you. We recommend specific paintings. So the model has definitely evolved, but I think the high level concept's the same.
Super interesting. So the original idea, it sounds like, would be there would be this flood of people just on their computers or mobile devices checking out Masterworks and saying like, okay, I'll buy a share in that painting. I'll buy a share over there in that new artist's next works or whatever. But instead, it was more human to human going through the financial advisors. Is that more or less correct?
I think that's right. And, you know, when we started the business, we didn't even really know how much art was appreciating, right? There weren't, like other asset classes, you can go and you can look and see how much has the S&P 500 gone up over the past 25 years, but there weren't reliable art indices that really tracked the performance. So we had to build everything from the ground up, right? Like, we had to build the first art index that really tracked performance in the art market. We had to decide what artist markets do we think are the most interesting, will appreciate the most. We had to figure out how do we source. You know, I think today we've sourced over $30, $40 billion in art. You know, we were kind of building everything from the ground up. There wasn't like a Bloomberg terminal for the art market that we could just use to figure out how to invest in it. So yeah, I mean, it's been a process.
So are most of the art, is it hanging in people's homes? And then, or they're with the collector or they're with the artist themselves, and then they decide like, okay, I'm going to sell a portion of this.
We buy 100% of a painting on the Masterworks balance sheet before we sell it off to investors. So I think we have 440 paintings in the collection now, valued between $500,000 and $30 million each. It's about $1 billion in AUM. But 100% of those paintings, after we offer them to investors, are ultimately owned by investors. The paintings are stored in Delaware. We do that to avoid sales and use tax, and then we lend them out to museums for relevant exhibitions.
Really interesting. I'd like to go back a little bit into the start of your journey, and then we'll go all the way up to present day. But when you were, you know, first starting out as a kid, were you doing this alongside going to school? Like, how did it work, and what was the first business?
Yeah, it's a funny story. So my very first company, for those who are old enough, remember it. So we wound up building the most popular game on the internet when I was in high school, and it was 1996, 1997, and we ran these Punch the Monkey ads. It was a sweepstakes game online, and I think at the time it was like the 14th most popular website on the internet. The game was initially built by me and one other friend of mine at the time, and the thing just took off, right? So when I graduated high school, I can't remember, we had whatever, 70 employees. When I was 18, 19, we had 150 employees. So it was this very fast learning experience of really being a kid and running a company. And then when, you know, in March of 2000 happened, that's really when bubble burst and the dot-com bubble collapsed. But for whatever reason, that didn't really hit the industry until November of 2000. I remember, like it was yesterday, I remember November of 2000 losing 80% of our customers in like a 2-week period. And that was as important of a learning experience as, I think, you know, growing the company rapidly. That was my first business. And I think in some ways, it's still the most impactful to my career.
Mm-hmm. And were your parents entrepreneurs? What, like, or was this instinctual?
My parents definitely were not entrepreneurs. So my dad was an engineer. My mom was a teacher. You know, my mom, I can't remember if it was my mom or my dad, but maybe it's both of them. I remember them sitting down with me at some point and saying, Scott, you know, this internet thing is not going to last. You have to go back to school. I never went to college, but they were convinced that the internet was not going to last. So,
where did you go next?
So after that company imploded, really the skill set that we had was advertising, because all of our revenue was generated from advertising. So after that company, I started a company called AdKnowledge, which became a large online ad network. I think we had 500-600 employees at the peak. So we ran a CPC marketplace where advertisers can bid on advertising across display inventory, email inventory, in games, etc. So I spent over a decade really running that business. And then after that, really left and kind of went into the fintech space.
Excellent. So you were just kind of like, as you were moving along, it seems like it was your entrepreneurial journey from business or idea to idea. It was almost organic in that you uncovered another thing that you could apply your business building acumen to, but it was almost tangential to the prior company.
Yeah, there's always been some relationship to something I know or that I feel like I have experience with. So for example, yeah, I started a series of online advertising companies and then decided to get out of that and go into fintech. And the first fintech business was a company called Payability. And the idea behind that company was that I had seen all of these online ad networks basically pay their publishers, right? So if you're a content publisher and you run ads from some ad network on your website, a lot of those ad networks are paying publishers on 30, 60, 90 day payment terms. And there's a consistent theme where publishers didn't want that, right? They wanted to be paid faster. So the idea behind Payability, at least version one, was to help those publishers get paid faster by essentially digitally factoring their receivables. Mm-hmm. So a publisher could more or less plug into Payability and start getting paid in real time for what they were owed by those ad networks. So there's always been a theme like that. Like with most of the stuff I've started, have some experience with it in the past, mm-hmm, in some way, shape, or form. You know, I have tried starting a few things where I have no experience and those have failed, but in general, I try to have some relationship.
Now, do you ever think about just sticking with the one company, but iterating on the products within that company versus starting a whole new company and then going kind of in sequence like that?
It's a good question. So at AdKnowledge, you know, that business, we acquired over a half dozen companies when I was there. We started several companies within it. And we often talked about that, right? Like, does it make sense for us to be doing things within the company, or should these really just be separate initiatives where businesses are run separately and independently? I think it's a hard question. And the reason I think it's a hard question is a lot of people approach that question by saying, you know, is there synergy between different businesses under a holding company? And I think that's part of the question, but I also think there's organizational dynamics. Like as organizations become larger and larger, they typically become less productive and more inefficient, right? So I think there's an efficiency trade-off with things running smaller and independently versus a synergy trade-off. And to keep things together as businesses really scale, I think you get to feel like there's really, really strong synergy because those efficiency trade-offs happen pretty fast.
And with the businesses that you've started, and we talked about how most of your time is spent with Masterworks, were you able to find a capable CEO that could lead those other businesses and really run with it and scale them?
Yeah. We've had amazing CEOs that have run businesses, and we've had not amazing CEOs that have run businesses. And for non-entrepreneurs and people that really aren't in the business world, I see so many comments on Twitter and elsewhere about this all the time. You know, there's this general sentiment that CEOs make too much money. You know, I'd say the flip side of that is that most hired CEOs that go into an organization fail. There's lots of CEOs that destroy huge amounts of value because they lack competency. So it is very hard. I mean, it takes years and years and years to find that one right person to run a company. I think at this point in my career, I would prefer to grow people into that role rather than hire from the outside, just because it's so hard to find the right person. Even when you find the right person, the batting average of success is still low.
Have you ever found like that one trait or signal from a person you're interviewing where you feel like you have a very high correlation with them ultimately being successful? Like in the interview process, are you meeting people like, I know that person's going to be amazing?
Yeah, you know what I tell managers at Masterworks, and this is just, I think, how I think about the world, is that if you look at research on hiring, the most successful hiring managers hire correctly 60% of the time, right? The best of the best of the best of the best of the best. The worst hiring managers hire correctly 10% of the time. So if you just accept that as a framework and you say, you know, we're probably not the best managers in the world. We're probably not at 60%. We're probably whatever, at 30% or 40%. Then I think to really have a high performing team, you have to create a culture where managers are comfortable moving people out who don't perform. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's the hardest thing for a lot of organizations, but the reality is hiring is very, very, very difficult. There's no real interview structure. I mean, we do personality profiles. We've tried to do, you know, behavior-based interviews. We do case studies. It's still not 100% predictive, right? Like it's just very hard to be great at it. So if you just accept the fact that you're not going to be great at it, then your next best option is to move people out quickly when they're not working to create better culture.
And how do you balance between, and I see that, you know, on your homepage, you have a nice video focused on what it's like at Masterworks. How do you balance between having a high performing culture and also one that, you know, is kind of has that warm feel to it?
I get that question a lot, and I'm definitely, from a leadership perspective, I'm not the warm, fuzzy CEO guy. But I think they're the same, meaning if you ask that question the opposite way, and I've had businesses like this where you say the business, you know, is not performing, business is declining, but whatever, you have a ping pong table, you have happy hours every day, like that doesn't work either, right? Like that's a fake culture where everyone knows that they're not really winning, but they're pretending like they're winning because of all this other stuff that the company is trying to do from a culture perspective. I think winning is a prerequisite to having a great culture. Mm. I think from there, you can add on to it. But at the end of the day, like most high-performing people want to be on a winning team. They don't want to spend decades of their life focused on businesses or initiatives where they just feel like they're not winning.
Mm-hmm. And by winning, you mean they're seeing how the company is growing and they're seeing how what they're doing is producing results for the company?
I think it's winning for them, and I think it's winning for the company, right? Like their career is growing, they're making more money, the value of their equity is going up, the people they're working with are really talented, they're working on interesting projects that are hard to solve, the company's scaling. I think it's all of those things, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's the best insight or advice that you've ever been given related to being an entrepreneur?
There's nothing really that stands out. I mean, I think being an entrepreneur is like having this toolbox of 20 different tools that you can pull out and approach problems differently, right? And I think your goal is to just kind of like add a new tool every year. So I don't think there's really anything specific. Like there is no magic bullet. Like the really hard thing about being an entrepreneur is that it doesn't matter how great everything is going, you're going to wake up tomorrow and something's not going to go great. You know, I used to tell my dad all the time, whenever I'd talk to him on the phone, he'd always say, you know, how was your day? And I'm like, I don't know. Like I had 10 things that were great that happened. I had 10 things that were horrible that happened. Like it's always kind of a mixed bag. So I think it's just getting used to that and then slowly improving over time.
Do you think 10 years from now, you'll be continuing to scale Masterworks? You'll be starting other companies?
It's a good question. So here's the thing about Masterworks that I think is incredibly unique. And I use this analogy for lots of people. So we believe that, and I think almost empirically, art is the largest asset class that has never been securitized. And the analogy that I use is art is roughly a $1.5 trillion asset class. Venture and private equity is $3.5 trillion. The difference is that there's 6,000 firms that help people allocate to venture and private equity. There's really only us in art today. Mm-hmm. So in terms of that total available market dynamic that we talked about earlier, in terms of problems you're trying to solve, like the great thing about this problem is this is a massive problem. So I think, you know, I think this is a problem that I could spend the rest of my life on. You know, I don't know how to think about that practically, but it's definitely the only business that I've been involved with where I feel like the growth opportunity is just very long-term and very, very large.
And is there an equivalent to like owning the S&P within the art world?
Yeah. I mean, at some point we're working on those products now. You know, in a perfect world, you could buy an ETF that gives you beta-like exposure to contemporary art. I think we're many years away from that. We're working on products now, you know, ourselves in partnership with other firms. But yeah, I think over time, the product set will continue to evolve.
We're coming up on time. I have two final questions. One is, can you tell us about a person who has had a profound influence on you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, there's a lot of people that have definitely influenced me from a career perspective. I mean, I honestly would go back to parents, frankly, literally. You know, my mom, at least from a Masterworks perspective, could really be credited with getting me into art. My father was an engineer, so my dad had me on computers at a very young age, really, you know, even pre-internet, doing bulletin board system stuff for those who know what that is. So I think those very early years are really critical for a lot of people. I have this friend who's one of the top classical pianists in the world, and he has a foundation where he teaches high-performing kids how to play the piano. He was telling me the other day, he's like, the thing that's amazing about these kids is like, if they're not great by the time they're four, they'll never be great. I think those early years and influence are probably the most impactful.
Something interesting that you said, one of your friends is in a completely different area, you know, profession wise. Is that the case with like people close to you? Do you have like a really interesting mix of folks you normally interact with?
Yeah, I mean, definitely now at my age, I would say my friend group is very diverse. You know, it's definitely not just like the tech crowd friend group, but I find them more interesting. It's also one reason why I like Masterworks and I like the art market. It's a totally different thing from typical tech companies. So I think the diversity is what makes life interesting.
Last question. Can you tell us about a charity cause or other endeavor that you're passionate about?
Yeah, well, I have my own foundation. So there's, you know, we've done lots of different things with that foundation. We've built schools in Cambodia and Vietnam, computer labs. I think now we're at a process where we're trying to figure out, you know, what to do next. In the nonprofit world, it's always tricky because there's so many people that want you to give money to so many initiatives. And you're always trying to figure out what can be most impactful. I think we haven't totally figured that out yet, but hope to do that sometime soon.
Well, really appreciate you taking the time. This has been a great conversation. I know our audience will find this very insightful. So thank you again, Scott.
Thanks for having me.